Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. This is podcast episode 92, and we're going to pick back up the series with part three of The Inevitable Police State. Now, before I take off on this subject, I want to just say, if I haven't emphasized it enough already, I want to emphasize it here again. What I'm talking about is not, this is not an excuse for police bashing. This is not saying we have no need for law enforcement or no need for any kind of legal activities by agencies. It's none of those things. What this series is about is, once a society accepts the concept that there are some members of that society who, simply by having a badge and putting on a uniform, have rights above and beyond the rest of that community, once that is accepted into society, the police state is inevitable. And it's not a matter of individual police doing this or that, or individual police accepting this or that. It's a matter of the entire society has accepted the path that will inevitably lead to a police state. And that's the purpose of this series, and that's what I'm trying to show. And I can, in the end, if we do this correctly, I'll be able to show you what the solution to this situation is as well. Okay, now I want to start this off as I have on each of these, by reading a quote from L. Neil Smith. "A libertarian is a person who believes that no one has the right, under any circumstances, to initiate force against another human being, or to advocate or delegate its initiation. Those who act consistently with this principle are libertarians, whether they realize it or not. Those who fail to act consistently with it are not libertarians, regardless of what they may claim." L. Neil Smith. And as always, I want to throw in the disclaimer, this does not mean that you can't have self-defense. You absolutely can have self-defense and the zero aggression principle, or the non-aggression principle. Okay, so now back to the concept of the police state as inevitable. As I have stated, I want to do a real quick recap of where we've gone. I gave you a little bit of a history as to how it was that we began having actual police around 1800, starting in London and starting in the bigger cities, and then infecting out further as it went. At the same time that the state was expanding and becoming more than just a small localized infection, as the state expanded through the 1800s and came to its height with the progressives in the early 1900s, police followed the exact same pattern, and they were an embedded part of the process of bringing the state to its fullness. Now, realize that when I say the state to its fullness, the state has further to go. If you can imagine the life stages of a human being, you get to be around early 20s to mid-20s or so, and you're pretty much the size and the strength you're going to be. You're pretty much at your peak of your physical development, somewhere around that time. On the other hand, you may not come into your peak of everything that you have the potential to be for years further. So if you compare that to the state came to its physical completion somewhere around the early 1900s, as the monarchs around the world were destroyed and the modern state stepped up and took over. However, there are still places in the world where the state is not fully, does not fully have a grasp yet, but that doesn't mean it won't. The state still has room to grow, and once again, don't get the state as the bigger entity confused with what most people refer to the state as being the separate governments that dwell in Washington, D.C., or London, or Paris, or wherever. The state itself is that condition in your mind when you accept this concept that human beings need to be ruled over by a class of other human beings that are not held responsible for their actions, and that they can tax us as they like, and they can use aggression and violence against us as they like, and they can prop their whole little process up with a series of layers and layers of lies and distortions. That's the state. And at this point in time, really, we've almost come to the point of where there is only one state, even though there are multiple governments in the world. We've almost come to the point of where there is basically one state. And that's still another level of maturity for the state, but it, again, is inevitable. Now, let's get to the police. I wanted to emphasize that it is not, as I said a moment ago, it is not the individual police that are the problem. Human beings act according to a series of sets of circumstances and tendencies. However, that's not the problem. The problem is the concept of the state. Once people begin to accept the possibility of having, well, this being a Bad Quaker podcast, that was our first interruption of the podcast. Hopefully I'll be able to clip that out and not make the transition too awful chunky. Okay, so I'll try to pick back up on somewhere about where I was. I was trying to say that we cannot blame the expansion of the police state and the inevitable police state upon individual police any more than, you know, I've said this before about other animals and their nature. If you tease a snake and the snake bites you, you should not be angry at the snake. The snake has not done anything outside of its nature. And if you find a lion and you poke it with a stick and the lion basically bites your arm off, or mauls your head half off, you shouldn't be surprised, because the lion has certain aspects of its nature and it will respond in certain ways. And the same goes with any other particular animal. You shouldn't, if you're out swimming around a coral reef and a shark bites a chunk out of your hip, it's not because you should be, you know, in the process of this, you shouldn't be angry at the shark or shocked that the shark would do such a thing, or decide that you want to pursue all sharks and hunt them down and punish them. None of that is a logical response. What you need to realize is that it is within the nature of that particular animal to behave in a certain way. And human beings are no different. When we take a human being and we provide for them undue authority, the ability to dress up in a costume of authority, whether that be a judge or a police officer or a soldier or anybody else in society, you provide for them the opportunity to dress up so that they appear to have some type of unnatural authority. And then you make them at least partially immune to the consequences of their actions. And somebody might argue, well, no, police are held to, there are distinct characteristics that police can behave under certain circumstances that a normal non-police citizen cannot do. I cannot just flip my lights on behind some car and expect him to pull over under my command. I cannot just march up to him and demand his driver's license. I cannot demand from him that he get out of the car and walk a straight line. And yet we accept that from a police officer. Now, the arguments can be made, well, this has to be done for public safety. No. Now, you're falling into a trap, and this is where the flaw comes in. The flaw comes in all the way in the origin, in accepting the idea that the community cannot police itself, that you need to separate out individuals and give them greater authority and special rights and costume them in a way that separates them from the rest of the public and give them levels of immunity that the public doesn't have. And then you expect their behavior to not go afoul at some point? See, that's where the problem comes in with the whole concept of the state. If you take a certain body of people and you say, well, we're gonna set you people up and you're going to make laws to tell all the rest of us how to behave, but you won't completely be held to the same level of with those laws. We'll figure out exceptions on how you won't have to be held responsible for your actions. Oh, and by the way, you get your funding by taking it from other people, whether they want to give it to you or not. When you set up these processes, then when humans react in the way that humans are guaranteed to react, you shouldn't be surprised. you should know that that's the process that's guaranteed from the very beginning of this when you accepted that concept of the state to begin with. So when we accept the concept of police and we reject the, well, for instance, if you think about the old sheriff view, going back into old ancient England and ancient Celtic societies, now don't get in your mind these legendary ideas of the Sheriff of Nottingham and things like that that come out of literature and out of the state's the state's storytellers and apologists. But the actual role of the sheriff, as you go back into ancient Celtic culture and ancient English culture, that was not one of an aggressive person with extra human rights. This was an individual that was part of the community and was recognized as part of the community as an arbitrator. And but I'm not going to get into that for now. All I will say is that the abandoning of the traditional role of the sheriff and the adopting of the state's false version, and that is the police. And again, this is not an attack on individual police. This is indicating that the natural sheriff position was abandoned, and we were given this, we were offered this false version, this police version by the state. And when we accepted that, then the inevitability of a police state was guaranteed at that point in time. The state does not back up. The state never unratchets itself and quietly slithers back into its den. It always expands. It always grows. And if for some reason it overgrows its temporary boundaries, it will pull back slightly, only enough to where the minds of men are again slumbered, and so the state can expand once more. And it always expands far further than it was the last time. And this is going to continue all the way to the time where the state reaches its complete and total maturity. And at that time, when it dies, then we'll deal with that in a different time. Okay, so then now I wanted to further recap what I was talking about just by running over some of the basic points through my notes here. So this is just going to be a little bit mechanical, but I just want to get past it. This is what we covered in the first... what is this, the third? This is the third in the series. So this is what we covered in the first two parts of this series, that, as I said, the local police are a temporary transition to a police state. The self-selection bias and regulatory capture are the two economic means, the mechanisms, rather, the economic mechanisms that guarantee, for instance, let's say if you jump off a cliff, the mechanism that guarantees that you're going to crash on the ground below the cliff is called gravity. So just like gravity interacts with matter, the self-selection bias and regulatory capture interact in any type of a situation where there is authority and there is a governmental structure and agencies that are involved. Okay, now I use the example of the Sheriff Andy and the Deputy Barney Fife. Now, I realize this can be offensive to some people in law enforcement, but if you really think about it for a minute, take away all the cartoonish stuff that was put in there for comedy relief and for entertainment on television. And if you really look at the nature of the Sheriff Andy person, he was a good man, he was an intelligent man, he was a kind man, and he was entirely motivated with the desire to help his community and improve the human state. On the other hand, the Barney character was entirely driven by the need to justify himself and to dominate other people. So we have the concept of police from its very beginning appealed to two types of people, the Andy or the A type and the Barney or the B type. Now at first, and for a very long time, the Andy types, the A types, dominated police work and dominated police forces around the world. I shouldn't say around the world. I should say mostly in Western cultures. In some cultures, the B types jumped right out and started taking a stronger advantage than they did in most of the Western culture. But to a large extent, in especially in the United States and Canada and in most of Europe, the A types dominated police work, at least in the beginning and for the most part throughout the last couple centuries. But slowly the balance tipped, and these effects of self-selection bias and regulatory capture drove the A's into lesser positions and rewarded the B's. And as this took place, the B's moved more effectively into the government structure and were rewarded by this process. And more it pushes the A's into lesser positions, lesser influence, and more rewards for the B's and actual punishment for the A's. So it drives the A groups into a position where it no longer is as appealing to new A types to come into law enforcement. And it is more appealing to new B types to come into law enforcement. And I talked about how this exact same thing goes on in the corporate structure. And that's why if you have a really large old corporation, what you'll find within the structure is that the middle and upper management, each generation of those managers gets worse and worse and worse, lazier, less innovation. They intentionally drive down the more promising go-getters, the honest, the hardworking. Those people are driven down, or they're driven out into engineering or other aspects of the company, out of management. Well, the B types are rewarded by the whole process until now, to where we've come to now in 2012. The B types almost dominate all the upper classes of almost all the main industrial and banking aspects of business. And that's because of this self-selection bias that's built in by the state. Keep in mind what I talked about, that the corporations would not exist without the state. The current banking model would not exist without the state. These are not natural aspects of the market. This is not capitalism we're talking about here. This is fascism, where corporations and the government marry and produce this I'm trying to use polite language, but they produce this odd metamorphosis out of capitalism and into fascism. And that's what we have right now. So we don't have the best the market can produce at the upper levels of the corporate world. What we have is what the state has produced. And that's what we have in charge of the main part of the corporate world and the banking world. Same with mass media, same with the government itself. And again, the distinguishment between the individual governments, like those in Washington and London or whatever, and the bigger entity of the state, that thing that we believe in that causes us to accept these aggressive governments. Okay, now, there is one problem. When I was talking about regulatory capture, I went back and I listened to the previous podcasts, and I realized that I didn't, from an economics point of view, I didn't make a clear argument. I made a lot of assumptions in my argument. I didn't make a clear argument that regulatory capture was taking place by police forces. I used the example, and I think it's a good example, of the DUI checkpoints, but I didn't follow through and really explain how it becomes regulatory capture. And on the small local level, it becomes regulatory capture because as the police set up their checkpoint or whatever, you know, it could be a speed trap, it could be anything that generates revenue. As they do this, they essentially they bring the local city council or the local mayor's office or whatever local structure that regulates the local police. Once the police begin to generate funds, the local government sees that not as something that they are to keep in check for the safety of the public. They see it as a mechanism to bring in more money and more power into the city government. You see, the original theory was that local police are kind of the in-between between the local government and the local population. They work for the population, and they work for the government. And in doing so, they protect both the local population and the local government. But when the local police take on the role of providing funding for the local government, which in the past, the past model was that the local government is funded strictly by taxation, which is theft, yes, but once the local government is stealing all that it can steal from the local population, once the local government figures out it can use the police legally to steal more, then the role of the police is no longer just the same as like any other aspect of local government where they're just doing their job. It leaves that realm and it takes on a new, more important realm of as a revenue generating agency. And so the influence of the police begins to twist the minds of the local government, and in essence the local police capture that aspect of local government. And once this starts to happen, we can see this on happening in places like Los Angeles, where the local police are almost totally out of control. And the local police got to the point of where they started putting up all the traffic cameras, and local people there fought back. And there were even groups that organized that proved that the cameras did not reduce accidents in intersections. The cameras did not slow traffic down. What the cameras did do was generate funding for the city and actually caused more accidents, because people were more likely to accelerate at the last moment or stand on their brakes at odd times. And this actually caused more accidents. So in that sense, as Los Angeles teetered on the verge of the police completely influencing the city, the local individuals, the local citizenry, was able to use the last gasps of their power to influence the city to get rid of the traffic cameras. But you know, this is what I was saying a minute ago. The state, this monster, always reaches out further, and then when it gets its little paws slapped, it pulls back a little bit, but never all the way back, never back to its original spot. And then as soon as the public slumbers, it reaches out further than it did the last time. And that's how this thing grows and grows and grows. Currently, there's a story out, and if I can remember to do it, I'll put a link to it on the webpage where this file exists, where we loaded this file, rather. Of a in Florida, let me see if I have this in my notes. Yeah, here it is, the Sun Sentinel in Florida, where the police have set up this surveillance. Boy, it looks like something out of a Mad Max movie or something. It's just really this nasty looking armed vehicle that's like some kind of a almost bus like armed vehicle, and or armored, I should say, armored vehicle. And they put this thing out with all these draconian warnings all over it. You're being watched. You're being watched. We're watching you. We're looking at you. And the citizenry just kind of like glances at it and goes on about their business. Well, things are getting bad, so we have to be safe. And again, let me take you back to that very first episode of this. The reason why crime is getting worse is because police are ratcheting up their patrols and ratcheting up the amount that they're policing, and that causes a reaction. Now, let me just clarify this a little bit. Stefan Molyneux probably has gone into this more than any other individual in the liberty movement, so if it sounds like I'm stealing from him, I probably am, but the way this cycle works is once a community or once a society accepts the idea that a small group of individuals with way too much authority can use aggressive violence to keep the other members of the society doing what let's have two groups, Group A and Group B, not to be confused with the Andes and the Barneys. Let's say Group 1 and Group 2. Group 1 are the authorities, and group two authorize the authorities. And so once this relationship begins and group one is given the ability to use aggressive violence and theft, and group two accepts that as being okay. Now, once that takes place, then it will always get worse. There, group one will always become more and more aggressive. In this case, think of Hans Hermann Hoppe's argument that when one agency is given the monopoly of determining what is justice and determining all arbitration is carried out by one agency, including conflicts involving that agency. Once you accept that, then you guarantee that that agency will pretty much always choose in its own best behalf against the group two that I was talking about a moment ago. So once this infects society, this is the state. This is what I'm talking about. This is the state. Once we accept as a public the concept that one group of people can use aggressive violence to inflict their will upon us, and they can steal from us as they wish, once we accept that, then generation by generation we weaken ourselves, and and it teaches our children that this is the way that you get things accomplished, through aggression and through violence and through theft. And generation after generation of using that, Nikki has her squeaky toy, so we're going to be entertained with Nikki's squeaky toy for a while here, but that's how it is at badquaker.com. Once each generation is taught this from cradle to grave, that the proper method for human beings to interact with one another is to use aggression and theft. Once you begin to bring that in to society, then each generation accepts that, and each generation grows more aggressive. The other aspect of this is, once you begin to realize that rather than settling a problem with your neighbor, all you have to do is call up this aggressive agency, and they'll come out and they'll use aggression on your neighbor for you, and you're shielded from it. You see, once these two aspects of the state are accepted into society, then it's a constant spiral of more and more lies, more and more aggression, and more theft. That's inevitable as each generation gets more and more accustomed to this process. So then as society becomes more aggressive and as theft becomes more predominant, then the response of the state, which created this atmosphere, is to bring in more aggression and more theft. And so if you look to the state to solve the problem the state has created, then the state only has those three methods: lies, aggression, and theft. And so as more state comes in, it teaches society to be more aggressive, tend more towards lies, and tend more towards theft. And so the police are not the solution to aggression, lies, and theft. More police create more aggression, lies, and theft. You see? You have to step back away from it. But you can't as long as the cycle is perpetuating. And that's our solution, and we'll get to that. Not right now, though. Okay, so I think I was going to cover regulatory capture, and I think I started on that when we got interrupted. But, yes, and I did the local. I talked about a DUI checkpoint or a seatbelt checkpoint or speed traps or whatever. And the regulatory capture on a local level takes place when the local police start bringing in enough funding to where the city council no longer has the power to stand up to them. And at that point, the local police become out of control, and you have situations starting to spark up now in the U.S. where local chiefs of police have deposed the mayor of a town. The elected mayor is kicked out and the chief of police takes over. And not just in one location. This is starting to happen with more frequency. Okay, now on a federal level, let's just take something. For example, you have the confiscation laws that started to come into effect in the 1980s, and immediately there was some reaction to this, but like anything else, first there's a law changed because there's a necessity for it. We have to do this. Think of the children. And so then as time progresses, the fruitfulness of how evil this law is starts to become more and more apparent. Now, I have a article. Let me pull this up here. Over at a wonderful website, the Future of Freedom Foundation, and I'll put the link to this on the page at badquaker.com, we have an article by Jarrett B. Wolstein, and it's called How Police Confiscation is Destroying America, and it's a two-part article. And I'm just going to tease a little bit of this. I'm just going to read a little bit for you, and I'm often clumsy when I read somebody else's work, so bear with me. My reading is not so great when I'm not the author. Throughout America, police are now seizing cars, houses, and bank accounts without trial and killing innocent Americans. The police now have the legal power to confiscate anything and everything you own without trial, conviction, or even indictment. Police are seizing cars, bank accounts, homes, and businesses from at least 5,000 innocent Americans each week. If we resist a police confiscation, they can even cripple or kill you with impunity. Now, that's a pretty, and I'm stepping out of the article for a moment, that's a pretty hard accusation. But let's just keep reading here. Do you want proof? Every Wednesday, Section D of USA Today newspaper lists the latest confiscations by the Drug Enforcement Agency. There, in tiny 7-point type, you will find the latest list of weekly seizures of pocket cash, bank accounts, cars, and homes by just this one government agency. More and more government agencies are joining in this feeding frenzy, and you and I are the prey. Agencies now confiscating property from innocent Americans include the FBI, the Coast Guard, the Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Post Office, the Bureau of Land Management, the Security and Exchange Commission, and the Department of Housing, plus thousands of state and local police departments. A sign of the times, many police departments now have their own moving vans for carrying away everything you own. Your property, your liberty, and your life are under siege. Here are a few examples. And then it goes on to document this wild, what we would hope would be an exaggerated accusation. But the problem is it's not an exaggerated accusation. It's real. Now, we don't necessarily see it. It's like anything else. You know, people get up in the morning and they maybe see a little bit of news on the television and they go to work and their life is focused around the next 8 or 10 hours of trying to deal with everything at work, and they come home and the best they can do is maybe get an hour or two of news and maybe look at, you know, one or two websites or something. And the vast majority of us are stuck in that 8-hour day, 5-day-a-week stupor, and we just don't have the opportunity to really look around and see what's happening. But it is happening. It's happening on a greater and greater scale. And more as this infects police forces around the country, it gives them the opportunity now to become far more than what they were just when they were writing tickets and stopping people for DUI checkpoints. Now they have funding that rivals anything that the feds can bring into a community. Now, let me see if I can get back to my notes here. It's probably been a couple of weeks. I'm not sure exactly when this was up on Lou Rockwell's website, but Lou Rockwell did an interview with Bill Anderson. And this interview with Bill Anderson, and I'll put a link to this also on the page where this file appears at badquaker.com. This interview with Bill Anderson focused mostly on the work that Bill Anderson has done in exposing prosecutorial shenanigans. And Bill Anderson has kind of been leading the way on that. this started, and he goes into this in the interview. It's well worth listening to the interview. I think it's maybe a 15-20 minute interview, but it's really good. And be sure and get over to badquaker.com and click the link there, and you'll get to the interview at Lou Rockwell. But Bill Anderson started this process with the Duke lacrosse case, where the boys were, there was some athletes that had just horrible accusations against them. And Bill Anderson was watching like the rest of us were. And he saw some oddities and some inconsistencies. And so he started to look into it a little bit. And he started to see the vast amount of corruption that was in the prosecutor's office. And specifically the prosecutor in that case, how the guy had absolutely no inclination towards law or justice at all. It was all self-serving. And so Bill Anderson began exposing the fraud involved there, and it ended up in that prosecutor being debarred, and it was a big, you know, fiasco that took place. And fortunately, those, you know, it didn't turn out as bad as it could have for those young people involved. But still, their lives were turned upside down over it, and all because this prosecutor was, you know, he was the Barney type taken to its logical end. And Bill Anderson's work in exposing these people, he shows that this is not an isolated case. This is happening all over the United States. And even in the interview, he even mentions, I think he mentions, I can't remember if he mentions regulatory capture or self-selection bias. I think he mentions regulatory capture in that interview, just in passing, in sort of the assumption that you already know what he's talking about. But anyway, if you can, click on the link at badquaker.com, get over there to Lou Rockwell and listen to that interview with Bill Anderson, and you'll see what I'm talking about. So this is not just something affecting police. If it was just bad police, it could never get beyond a local level. It could never get beyond a single police force, of a single localized police force. And this is why I'm saying that it's not the fault of the Andes. It's not the fault of the police themselves. Some people would like to blame it on the police unions. And yes, that's an aspect of it. But the police unions are simply a part of the state. They're simply one more tentacle of the state. And all the things that I talked about that affects the way the corporate structure is, and affects the way the state, the way the government structure is, and the way the media, all those things that reward the B personalities and punish the A personalities, those all work in the police unions as well, driving out those who originally came in seeking good and seeking to serve, and rewarding those Barney types that are just there self-serving and just there to dominate people. Now, what is the ultimate end of this? Well, I want to bring up something that a good friend of mine that I've known on the internet for a long time, named Kelly, brought to my attention, and that is in regards to something that almost, you know, a lot of people, oh, we're going to have some dog barking. The dogs are on full alert, and we're going to have dog barking interrupting the Bad Quaker podcast once again. All right, let's see if we can pick this back up. The dogs seem to be calmed down. So once again, I have to try to figure out what I was talking about before the dog interruption. I think I was talking about my friend Kelly that gave me a link to, you know, if I can remember, I'll go ahead and put this link up as well. This was to, I think it was a NPR podcast that was in regards to a guy who had been he's a devout Catholic, and knowing about the history of the Spanish Inquisition, he decided to investigate it to try to find out how something that he had so much faith in could have been so dramatically wrong as to have the Spanish Inquisition. So he tried to figure out a reason for this. And as he looked it all over, And this is not an apology for the church, for the Catholic Church at the time. He is more than willing to lay blame within Christianity and within the Catholic Church as a part of it. But what he found was that, and he lays this all out very well in the interview that's in this podcast with NPR. Unlike popular belief and unlike even what we've been taught in state schools and so forth like that, the Spanish Inquisition, and of course there were multiple Inquisitions, but the Spanish Inquisition was an act of the state. Now, that's not to say the church was innocent. The church was complacent. The church was involved, but it was purely a political act of the state. It was a state-sponsored purging, specifically by Isabella and Ferdinand, the famous Queen Isabella that financed Christopher Columbus. This was an act of state aggression upon certain aspects of the people in Spain, and there was a lot of money and there was a lot of power involved. But it was strictly a state act. The fact that the church was used as a vehicle for this process was almost secondary to the fact that the state itself was doing it. And oftentimes, like for instance, today there can be all kinds of violence that can take place in the name of a particular religious organization, but when you boil it all down, you find out that really what we're talking about is state aggression. We're not talking about, it's not a part of the actual religion. It's just a state aggression under the guise of religion. An example of that could be, you know, some of the propaganda from World War II, some of the propaganda in the United States made out the Japanese people to be religious fanatics, and that this was all the fault of the emperor. When the facts came out, it was the emperor was pretty much a pawn in it, and it had nothing to do with their religion. It had everything to do with the fascist form of militant government that they had with the former warlords, the former... this is not a podcast on Japanese history. This is about police, the inevitability of the police state. So I'll try to get back to topic here. So anyway, I was just throwing that out about the Spanish Inquisition, that's an example of the inevitability of where the state will take things at some point in time. The state will, once the state gets enough power, the little excuses, whether it's the drug war, whether it's people speeding, or whether it's, securing the borders, or outside terrorism threats, or interior terrorism threats, or it doesn't matter. In the end, when the Inquisition starts, the real purpose for it will be government power and the aggression of the state. And it will be to feed the state and make the state stronger. And as I said, this is not just a problem within police forces, and it's not just a problem even with law enforcement in general, as in even through the prosecutors and so forth like that. This is a much bigger problem that's based on the very existence of the state. There was a situation just a few days ago that came to light. A lot of people are talking about it in the San Francisco Bay Area in California. A local school, evidently there were six-year-old kids playing on the playground, and they were playing tag. And in the process of playing tag, a teacher observed one of the children touching the other child somewhere in the leg or groin area. Now, that's pretty vague, but the teacher decided that it was sexual, that it was a sexual assault somehow. Six-year-olds playing tag, and the teacher saw one of them tag the other and decided that it was a sexual assault. So they took in this six-year-old into the principal's office, where for hours he was grilled by these adults. He was left alone. They used all the standard tactics that police and prosecutors use to intimidate witnesses or to intimidate an individual into confessing to a crime. They used all the standard tactics that the police use until they eventually convinced this six-year-old boy to confess that he had sexually assaulted this other child. Now, eventually his parents found out about it, and they had to go hire a lawyer, and they eventually got the school district to recant and clean the little boy's record and get this off his record. Of course, they had to take the boy to a separate school, get him away from that school, because it was just, and you can't undo the damage of taking the six-year-old into a room and adults just verbally abusing him for hours to get him to confess to something he doesn't even understand. Now, this takes us back to this podcast from the NPR. If you take the time and listen to this podcast about the Inquisition, and you listen to the guy describing in detail the methods used during the Inquisition, the questioning methods, and even the torture methods that were used, the intimidation methods, the fear tactics, all these things are exactly what are in today's acceptable methods of interrogating individuals, whether they're in a police station or whether they're, the terrible terror. Oh no, the terrorists have to be tortured. We have to waterboard them. We have to do these things for our safety, because otherwise they'll do these horrible things to us. Well, it was the same excuse back then. It was exactly the same excuse. And it's the same excuse that they used with this child, and this six-year-old child in California. This is for the greater good. This concept that comes along with the state, that you can do something bad and then get a good result. You can authorize some people in society to use aggressive violence so that we can get a good result. You see, this is where the flaw comes in. The idea that two wrongs can make a right. Now, I'm sure that everybody listening to this believes in your mind. You know this, that two wrongs cannot make a right. And yet, that's what the state is. The state is the existence of the idea that wrong, aggressive violence, theft, continuing lies, that somehow these wrongs can produce a right, can produce a good. This cannot happen. It's illogical to think that going to someone and aggressively stealing a third or 20% or 50% of their wages, that you can somehow then take that money and go do enough good with it that it makes up for the bad of stealing. This whole process is such backward thinking that it creates generation after generation of children growing up being taught these two opposite things. You can't do a wrong and make a right. You can't even do two wrongs and make a right. You can only do good to make things good. And yet, the government is going to tax you. The government is going to aggress upon you. The government is going to tell you what to do with your property. The government is going to tell you what you can and can't ingest into your body. That's fat. You can't have that. We're going to outlaw that. You can't have this type of food. We're going to outlaw that. We're going to punish this particular behavior with special types of taxes, because we've decided it was bad for you. So we're going to regulate your life like that. You see, once you accept that as being good, and you're teaching your children at the same time, two wrongs don't make a right, but then you're walking, you're saying one thing with your mouth, but you're doing something else with your feet. You're walking one thing, but you're talking something totally different. And you teach your children to live and accept this lie. That's what degrades society. That's what drives us further and further evil. And now, there's this huge myth, and even many people in the liberty movement have bought into this. And no, it's not a myth. It's a lie. It's a lie of the state. This idea that things are getting better. No, they're not getting better. Now, the market is always expanding. The free market, or what's left of the free market, is constantly innovating and constantly through the remnants of capitalism that still exist out there in the market, New products are introduced, and life gets better in the sense that we can develop new machines to do new tasks for us, and we can figure out new innovative ways of doing things that make things easier. But when it comes to the department that the state, the actual avenues of our lives that the state is involved in, those things are getting worse and worse and worse, and they have been getting worse for thousands of years. We are far less free today than we were 20 years ago. The state has constantly been on the move, constantly been growing, and constantly been becoming more and more aggressive. And the next generation will have more of its rights taken away than this generation. This idea that, well, we're going to draw a line in the sand and you can't go, once it gets to this point, we're going to do something about it. Sorry, you can't. You can't. That is not a logical path to take. And here's something else. Let me just address this too. There is this really, really dangerous, and it's worse than dangerous. It's harmful. This harmful lie that is believed by so many people in the liberty movement, that as long as you still have quote unquote gun rights, that we're still okay. We can still do something about it. No, you can't. No, you can't. Fighting the state. If you think the government is the problem, first off, you're wrong. The government is just the visible thing that you see. You can replace the government. Sure, we can tear down the government tomorrow. But what comes back will be worse. The state is your enemy, not the government. The concept that there are people who can use aggression and lies and steal from you, that's the problem, the state. And you can't use the weapons of the state to defeat the state. You can't use your guns to defeat the state. The state knows exactly how to deal with that. If you don't believe me, go on a little road trip, drive down to Waco, Texas, and look at the graves. The state knows how to deal with people who fight back using the weapons of the state. Now, I'm not saying don't have a gun. In the room that I'm in, well, no, I won't finish that sentence. I'm not saying don't have a gun. You have a right to protect yourself, and you have a right to own anything that you feel will protect you. But hear this if you hear nothing else from this podcast, and hear this if you hear nothing else from badquaker.com. Hear this one thing. You cannot defeat the state by using the weapons of the state. You can't do it. The only way to defeat the state is to withdraw from the state, is to recognize the state as a thing that we believe in, as an imaginary thing that we have accepted in our minds, and you stop accepting it in your mind, and you start moving towards freedom and liberty by doing it, not by fighting the state, not by going out jousting at windmills. You can't beat the state that way. We beat the state by realizing that the state is imaginary, and we stop believing in it. And then we begin acting as free individuals. We begin trading in underground everything that we can. We do it without the permission of the state, behind the state's back, underneath the radar, so to speak. All those other phrases like that that don't come to mind immediately. We just do it. We just become the free economy. And we do it without asking permission. And the state is going to go on, and it's going to grow to its maturity, and it's going to do what it's going to do. Now let's get into a little bit of a theology thing here. I try to avoid this as much as possible because I don't want to sound like the crazy guy with the sign out on the street corner screaming biblical passages at the top of his lungs, waving a sign that says the end is near. Well, first off, the end's not near. We have generations to go, folks. We have generations to go. Like, I hate to quote, well, okay, never mind, I won't. So, to get back to the fact that I try not to quote Bible and try not to look like the crazy guy on the street corner with the sign, and yet, if you look at the end of the book and you read what happens as the state grows and as it gets more and more powerful, it gets to the point of where it begins to lash out and fight and struggle. And at some point in time, it will control as far as what it knows to exist. It will control all commerce. It will control all travel. It will control all governments. It will control everything that it knows of. And at that point in time, it will have nothing else that it can dominate, and it will begin to destroy itself. And going by biblical passages, we're talking about something like a third of mankind will be wiped out by this beast, by the state, by that old dragon, by the decision of decisions of human beings to believe in an entity that doesn't exist. By doing that, we believe in the state. We believe in that old dragon. And when he gets to a certain point of desperation and he begins to devour his own, we have to be in a position. Generations of us have to prepare so that we are in a position so that that thing can thrash around and do everything that it's going to do. And when it dies, then we stand up and we win. Folks, thank you very much for listening to BadQuaker.com. For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to BadQuaker.com. Thank you very much, folks.